final case of the morning is Thomas against Guardsmart. Mr. Howe.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. When I was growing up back in the 70s, there was a movie with Suzanne Pleshette. If this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium. And I feel in a sense that if it's Monday, it must be the Seventh Circuit, since I'm back here with a substantially similar panel. In this particular case, we think that the starting point for the analysis, a logical starting point for the analysis, could be to consider what would happen if the cause of action arose after the Illinois Whistleblower Act were enacted.
We have some problems to get to before that, including subject matter jurisdiction. We issued an order to try to pin that down, and it doesn't seem to be pinned down yet. The revised jurisdictional statement says, essentially concedes that the notice of removal was false, and says that the LLC includes partnership with three partners. But it doesn't name the partnership, it doesn't name the partners, and asks us basically to take on faith the citizenship of the partners. You know, I would have thought that our order made it perfectly clear that nothing was to be taken on faith, particularly not given the concession that the notice of removal was false. Nothing is to be taken on faith, it has to be demonstrated. So where are we with respect to subject matter jurisdiction?
Your Honor, the entity at issue formerly was entitled Guardsmart, Inc. It is now Guardsmart, LLC.
As it was at the time the case was removed, which is when jurisdiction is established or not.
Correct.
So the statement, the notice of removal, which said that the removing party was Guardsmart, Inc., was false, and it withheld important jurisdictional information. We're now trying to get it, and despite our order, we still don't have it.
Your Honor, we can supply the names in a declaration.
Why were they not supplied in response to our order? I don't see how we could have been clearer that we wanted the names and citizenships of everybody down to the last level and not just a lawyer's ipsy dixit.
I will accept responsibility for that, Your Honor, because I had not understood this court's order to require the names to
be specified. We even cited cases in which we dismissed for lack of jurisdiction when an order like this did not lead to complete details.
Your Honor, if I may, the entity Guardsmart LLC has two members. The first member is now, it was at the time of the removal, it is an LLC, it is now a corporation. It was Guardsmart.
Oh, so the supplemental jurisdictional statement is itself false. We need to know, again, I thought our order made this clear, we need to know the jurisdictional details as of the date of removal. So if the first member was an LLC on the date of removal, we need to know its constituent members as of the date of removal and not the fact that it's now a corporation.
And as of the date of removal, the entity Guardsmart LLC had two members, Guardsmart Holdings LLC and a partnership. The partnership has three partners, two of whom are New York citizens.
Yes, so it says, but we have to take it on faith because it gives no details. And we're not at a position anymore to take it on faith because we already know that false jurisdictional statements had been filed on behalf of Guardsmark. The removal was predicated on a false jurisdictional allegation.
Your Honor, the removal wasn't, while incorrect, wasn't predicated on a knowingly false statement. The corporation had changed its corporate form shortly before the removal. As soon as we discovered that fact, we supplemented the record. We've stated that fact in the disclosure statement at the district court. We stated it when this was up on appeal in the first Thomas 1 case, and we stated it, we believe, here. If there are errors, they are errors of counsel, not of the client, and there are errors that we can correct.
We have separate questions. One is whether after multiple years of litigation we will give you another opportunity, and because two of the cases that we cited in our order said after you get the final opportunity in the Court of Appeals, that's the end of the line. No more chances. If we do give you another chance, we will then have to go through and figure out whether there's jurisdiction. Now, I just don't understand how an order as clear as the one we issued could not have been complied with.
Your Honor, may I seek leave orally to supplement by tomorrow with supporting affidavits the information that you seek?
The panel will consider that request.
May I submit the motion for leave?
Please proceed.
Thank you. As to the merits, we think that a logical starting point to decide whether the plaintiff's cause of action for retaliatory discharge is preempted under the Illinois Whistleblower Act is to consider what would happen if the events had occurred after the enactment of the act. Assume that on January 1 of this year, Mr. Thomas had gone on CBS 2 News and had given the same report. Assume on February 1 he was terminated. Assume on March 1 he filed this lawsuit. Would he have a cause of action under the act? Now, we believe that even the plaintiff does not dispute that he would not have a cause of action under the act because he did not report to government or law enforcement the issues that are set forth in his statements to CBS 2 News. We also believe that he wouldn't have a cause of action under the act because he didn't have a reasonable basis that Guardsmark had violated the law. Now, we believe that the act will, whistleblower act in that circumstance, would preempt the common law claim. And for that, we would cite the Illinois cases that say that where the legislature has provided a remedy, that the courts are loath to implement or to expand that remedy by judicial decree. So we think that had the events occurred today, Mr. Thomas would not have a cause of action under the act. Now let us turn then to the facts of this case, whether the Whistleblower Act applies retroactively. Now, this court has noted, not just on the issue of retroactivity, but generally, where the Illinois Supreme Court has not yet spoken on an issue of Illinois law, that the Seventh Circuit seeks to predict how the Illinois Supreme Court would rule. Now, on the question of retroactivity, as Judge Posner had noted several years ago in the Kopeck case, Illinois law had been in quite a state of a muddle on what was to be applied retroactively and what was to not. There have been four standards that the courts have developed.
Has any Illinois appellate decision applied the Whistleblower Act to conduct, primary conduct, that occurred before January 1, 2004?
No, the closest that I can cite for you is the Sutherland case, which in dicta, the First District in 05 stated that the Whistleblower Act codified the law, but to my knowledge, there's not yet been an Illinois case on this precise point. Over the years, the Illinois courts have used a variety of different standards for retroactivity. Originally, there was a vested rights approach that was used. Contemporaneously, in the second line of authority, the courts had used a legislative intent standard. Then, a number of years back in ComEd versus Will County, the Illinois Supreme Court adopted the U.S. Supreme Court's approach in the Landgraf case. And most recently, last year, in Coveney versus Bauer and the Atkins case, the Illinois Supreme Court has adopted a fourth approach on that, stating that under the Savings Act of Illinois, that it will apply acts retroactively if they are procedural, but prospectively only if they are substantive. Now, Your Honors, regardless of the precise language used, whether it be vested rights, legislative intent, Landgraf, or the procedure substantive distinction, there are a number of common elements in the approaches that the Illinois courts have had. One of those common elements is that there's always a tension between two policy principles. On the one hand, not wanting to disrupt settled expectations. On the other, wanting to apply the law as it exists at the time of decision. Another common element is that the questions of retroactivity are ones in which, as the U.S. Supreme Court had said in Landgraf, they're issues with which the courts have substantial experience. In a sense, it's like Justice Potter Stewart's famous admonition, you know it when you see it. Now, we believe that what that means is that the analysis of whether a statute is procedural and therefore retroactive or substantive and therefore prospective only, actually, that labeling of procedural versus substance is a conclusion reached at the end of the analysis rather than a decision to be made at the start of the analysis. And we believe that the Illinois Supreme Court would come to the conclusion that the Whistleblower Act here is procedural. And the reasons for that are the court has given guidance that it believes that a procedural provision is one that provides a method for the enforcement of rights or for obtaining redress. That was the Illinois Supreme Court's counsel last year in the Atkins case. And we believe that the Whistleblower Act here is remedial. As Sutherland had suggested,
I don't understand what the significance of that is. I mean, you've told us in your brief that Illinois says it follows the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf.
Sir?
Is there any argument you're making now that couldn't have been made in Landgraf itself? A retroactive application?
There is. We believe that under either a pure Landgraf test or under the Illinois Supreme Court's current jurisprudence, both standards would lead to retroactive application. But the additional provision, Your Honor, is that in Landgraf, the U.S. Supreme Court did not focus solely on the procedural substantive distinction, whereas in the Illinois Supreme Court's most recent jurisprudence, in Bowers and in Atkins, it's taken a look at whether this is, quote, procedural or substantive. And that wasn't really a standard that was at issue.
Now it sounds like you're saying that as you read the Illinois decisions, they're not following Landgraf.
Well, that's a matter of a debate between and among the members of the court, Your Honor. Within the recent cases dealing with retroactivity, Atkins is a good example. There are three members of the Illinois Supreme Court that either dissent or specially concur because they believe that their brethren in the majority are ill-advised to engraft onto Landgraf this additional substantive procedural distinction. We think that either under pure Landgraf or under the substantive procedural distinction that the Illinois Supreme Court would hold that this is procedural and therefore would apply the act retroactively. It is a remedial statute.
Yes. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wiesinger.
May it please the court, my name is Timothy Heisinger. I represent the plaintiff appellee Carl Thomas. Your Honor, we believe that this is a frivolous appeal and are asking the court to impose sanctions on the appellant for wasting this court's time. The argument about preemption has clearly been waived.
What do you know, if anything, about who the partners in this partnership are? I assume nothing.
Nothing.
Since they haven't even revealed the name of the partnership.
We would note that the court did raise a question about diversity jurisdiction in the first appeal in this case, and Guardsmark did provide, in response to the court's order, essentially the same information it has provided in response to the court's order in this appeal. And at the time, we had no reason to question the accuracy of the information provided in the first appeal, and we have no reason to question the accuracy of the information in this appeal as well.
Yeah, well, you may find that we, since it is now conceded that false jurisdictional information has been filed in federal court in this litigation by this litigant, you may understand that we are not willing to take anything on faith anymore.
But what we understand the court's position, and I guess the only thing I would ask is that I think the appropriate remedy in the matter, to be fair to both sides, would be to require Guardsmark to provide the information.
No, I can understand the argument that we should not sandbag your client because of the other side's continuing inability to provide accurate jurisdictional information.
Mr. Huizenga, Guardsmark claimed in its brief that you did not brief the issue of waiver of the waiver of the Whistleblower Act claim in response to its Rule 50B motion. Is that true?
I think that's correct. We did not specifically argue that the but I would point out, Your Honor, that actually in their 50B motion, they didn't really make a preemption argument. They didn't use the word preemption, and they didn't use a preemption analysis. What they said was, and this is why we didn't argue waiver, they said, look, there's this Whistleblower Act. They don't fit within it. And we simply pointed out in response, we never made a Whistleblower Act claim. So it's irrelevant whether we were just saying that it was irrelevant. The act was simply irrelevant, and they never argued preemption below.
So there would never be any way that, in your view, that you might have waived the waiver argument?
Right, because they didn't make the preemption argument below, and so there was nothing for us to waive. They only used the term preemption when they got to this court, and they studiously tried to avoid making a preemption argument because they knew how frivolous it was. So instead, they argued that we somehow didn't fit within the statutory claim, and of course, the simple response to that was we weren't making a statutory claim. We were making a common law claim. So we believe that there's no reason for this court not to find that the argument of preemption was waived. But even if the court were to ease the waiver doctrine, the act obviously doesn't apply retroactively to defeat our cause of action for the simple reason that Guardsmark's argument is self-defeating. It says that we should apply the statute retroactively because it's procedural, but then they say we lose because we failed to substantively fit within the statute. So the argument is self-defeating. If it was truly procedural, then we would have a claim under the Whistleblower Act. The fact that the Act provides substantive requirements is exactly why we don't fit within the Act and why we filed a common law claim. And with regard to the merits of the preemption, Guardsmark has not cited a case that's on point or that even is relevant to the issue of statutory preemption of existing common law causes of action. And we have cited a number of cases which stand for the general proposition that where there is a pre-existing common law claim and the legislature drafts a statute, passes a statute that deals with the same subject matter, it is not presumed that the legislature intended to preempt all common law causes of action, and the only way there would be preemption found is if the legislature specifically demonstrated an intent to preempt those common law claims. And, of course, Guardsmark points to nothing in the Act that shows any indication whatsoever that the Illinois legislature intended to preempt common law claims, and neither the language nor the purpose of the statute would show that there was any such intent. And I think the case that's closest is this court's decision in Brandon, where the defendant argued that the False Claims Act should preempt a common law retaliatory discharge action. And this court found that there was no evidence that Congress intended, by passing the False Claims Act, to preempt any common law retaliatory discharge claims, even though the False Claims Act does contain anti-retaliation provisions designed to protect employees. So for the same reason, we would find that there's no basis at all for this a claim of preemption of common law claims. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.